Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Today, we are plunging into a medical puzzle that's both heartbreaking and, frankly, quite frustrating. Creatine transporter deficiency, or CTD. Now, you might know creatine is, you know, that supplement athletes use, but when the body actually can't transport it properly, the consequences are severe. We're talking profound intellectual disability, major speech delays, seizures, and strong autistic behaviors.
It's really devastating, and it's thought to be one of the most common X-linked intellectual disabilities, which is significant.
Exactly. But here's the real kicker, the frustrating part. The standard treatment, just giving the patient oral creatine supplements, often fails completely.
Yeah, it rarely fixes the cognitive issues or even gets the creatine levels back up in the brain.
Why? Because the transporter, the protein that's supposed to move it, is broken.
Yeah.
The supplement just can't get where it needs to go.
The door is jammed, yeah. Essentially.
So our mission today is to really get into the weeds, to understand the structure of that broken protein, the creatine transporter 1, CRT1, which comes from the SLC6A gene. We need to figure out which mutations cause total failure and, maybe more importantly, if some mutations leave just enough function behind, could that open the door for personalized treatments? We're sort of building a framework for hope here.
And that framework really comes from some fantastic work we're highlighting today. You should definitely acknowledge the research team led by Taryn Deep and Gerald S. Lipschitz and their colleagues at UCLA. Their systematic approach has been, well, crucial in advancing our understanding of CRT1's structure and how different mutations actually affect its function.
Okay, so let's set the stage a bit more. Just how critical is this molecule, creatine, especially for the brain?
Well, the root problem is a loss of function variant in that SLC6A gene, and you absolutely need creatine phosphate. Think of it like a high energy battery ready to go instantly. It's essential for organs that burn a lot of energy quickly, the heart, muscles, and critically the brain. It rapidly regenerates ATP, the main energy currency of the cell.
Okay, so it's like the quick charge power bank.
Exactly. And the brain is uniquely vulnerable here. Other organs like the liver and kidneys can make some creatine, but the brain. Very limited ability to synthesize it. So it relies almost totally on the CRT1 transporter to actively pump creatine across cell membranes and, crucially, across the blood-brain barrier.
So if that pump fails?
The brain is essentially starved for this critical energy source.
And the clinical picture really reflects that starvation, doesn't it? You see those variable intellectual and growth delays, the severe speech problems, motor issues, autistic features.
Precisely. And the key diagnostic clue, the smoking gun, is that lack of brain creatine. They can actually see it using magnetic resonance spectroscopy, or MRS.
So if we want any hope of fixing this, we have to understand the transporter itself. CRT1. How should we picture this protein? It's not just a simple pore, right?
No, not at all. It's much more complex. Think of it like an intricate revolving door built into the cell membrane. It's a big protein made of 635 amino acids organized into 12 segments that span the membrane. We call these transmembrane, or TM, alpha helices. These act like the moving parts, the locks, the frame of the door itself.
Okay, a revolving door, I like that analogy.
And where a mutation hits on this door tells you a lot. Does it jam the mechanism? Does it prevent creatine from even blocking the entryway? Or does it mess up the protein folding so the door never even gets installed correctly in the cell wall?
Right. Different problems depending on where the break is. So how did the researchers figure out which parts of this complex door were absolutely critical? They didn't just randomly poke at it, I assume.
Huh. No, not randomly. They used a really clever two-pronged strategy. First, they looked at evolution, basically asking, what parts of this protein has nature refused to change over millions of years?
Because high conservation usually means high importance.
Exactly. If it hasn't changed, it's probably doing something vital. They compared the CRT1 amino acid sequence across various mammals, primates, dogs, rats, mice, and even zebrafish to map out these highly conserved regions.
Okay, that's the evolutionary angle. What was the second prong?
The second prong involved digging into human genetic data. They used something called metadome analysis, pulling data from Nome and ClinVar. This helps map which regions of the protein tolerate changes where benign mutations tend to land versus regions that are intolerant, where disease-causing mutations cluster.
So combining evolutionary pressure and human genetic evidence. Smart.
Very. And then, crucially, they didn't just stop at the bioinformatics. They did the functional validation in the lab. They actually synthesized 9 specific SLC6A8 variants known to cause disease different types, substitutions, deletions, even a duplication. They put these into cultured cells, 293 T cells, and then measured how much creatine those cells could actually take up compared to cells with the normal wild-type transporter.
Using a colorimetric assay, right? So they could directly see the functional impact.
Precisely. They measure the actual transport activity.
Okay, let's get to the findings then. You mentioned the evolutionary conservation. What did they find there?
Oh, it was striking. CRT1 is ancient and incredibly conserved. Across all the terrestrial mammals they looked at, the amino acid sequence was over 98% identical to the human one.
98%? That's huge.
It is. And get this, humans and chimpanzees, identical. 100% the same sequence for this protein. That level of conservation across millions of years really underscores its fundamental importance.
Wow. Okay, but there was some variability, that less than 2% difference. Where did those changes occur?
That's the key point. The tiny differences they found were almost exclusively located at the ends of the protein, the N-terminus and C-terminus, or in the flexible loops that stick out of the cell membrane, the peripheral parts.
Not the core machinery.
Exactly. The core machinery, those transmembrane domains 1 through 10, almost zero variability across all those species. It's like nature put a do not touch sign on those core parts. Any tinkering there is likely catastrophic.
And did this conservation map directly onto where the disease-causing mutations are found?
It mapped beautifully. When they looked at known patient variants from databases like LOVD, they analyzed 43 missense variants. Now, of the 8 variants found in those peripheral N and C termini,
let me guess, mostly benign.
100% were classified as benign or likely benign. The metadome scores confirm these areas are highly tolerant to changes. The protein can handle variation there.
Okay, but what about mutations hitting the core, those highly conserved TM domains?
That's where the story flips. Of the 10 variants they analyzed located within those conserved transmembrane domains, 70% were pathogenic.
70%. So hitting the core is much more likely to break it.
Much more likely. And specific domains like TM1, 3, 6, 8, and 10 showed marked intolerance. Even a single amino acid change in these critical regions seems likely to severely impair or abolish function.
Did they find any particular hotspots?
They did. There seems to be a cluster region for pathogenic missense mutations between amino acids 305 and 415. This area includes transmembrane domains 6, 7, and 8, part of that really critical core machinery.
And the functional tests, did they confirm this structure function link?
They absolutely confirmed it. Remember those 9 pathogenic variants they tested in cells? The vast majority, 8 out of 9, which involved changes in the TM domains or the core loops connecting them.
Let me guess, severely reduced function.
Profoundly reduced. They showed decreases in creatine uptake of 88% or more. Essentially, these transporters were almost completely non-functional. Broken revolving doors.
88% or more reduction.
Yeah.
So basically useless. But you said 8 out of 9?
Yeah.
There was one outlier.
Yes. And this is potentially the most exciting finding for patients. One variant called SD9 in the paper behaved differently.
Where was SD9 located?
It wasn't in the core TM domains. It was located in one of those peripheral extracellular loops outside the main transport machinery.
And its function?
It didn't completely crash the system. Cells with the SD9 variant transporter showed only a moderate reduction in creatine uptake, about 29% less than normal.
29% reduction, that means it still had over 70% of its normal function.
Exactly, 71% residual function. That's not a completely broken transporter, it's just less efficient. And that residual function could be a total game changer.
Okay, let's connect this back to the bigger picture. The intense conservation in the core, the severe impact when those core parts are mutated, it all points to strong negative selection, right? Evolution weeds out changes to the essential machinery.
Absolutely. The protein's architecture is incredibly precise. Most changes to the core are just not tolerated because they lead to disease.
Which makes that SD9 variant even more interesting. Being in a peripheral loop allowed it to have a milder effect.
That seems to be the case. The researchers suggested it might cause a subtle change in the protein shape or how it interacts with other molecules, making it less efficient at transport, but not completely killing its function.
So let's think about what this means for a patient walking into a clinic today. Right now, standard creatine supplements often fail.
Probably because most patients diagnosed so far have those mutations causing profound loss of function, that 88% or more reduction. Giving them more creatine is like, as you said, pouring water into a bucket with a massive hole in it.
But this new framework suggests we really need to personalize the approach.
Mm.
We need to know which mutation the patient has.
Precisely. Because if a patient has a variant like SD9, one that leaves, say, 70% of the transporter function intact, just making it less efficient.
Then maybe, just maybe, flooding the system with high concentration oral creatine could actually work for them. Could it compensate for the inefficiency?
That's the critical question and the major implication here. This research provides a solid framework for understanding these genotype-phenotype correlations. It suggests future treatment decisions really need to be guided by the specific mutation and its functional impact.
So you'd need functional testing?
Ideally, yes. Or at least strong predictive data based on the mutation's location and type. Variants causing that profound loss, the 88% plus reduction, are probably not going to respond well to simple supplementation. They might need more advanced therapies down the line, like gene therapy, perhaps.
But those moderate loss variants, like the 29% reduction with SD9,
those patients become really interesting candidates for tailored, possibly high-dosage creatine regimens. Functional testing or robust prediction based on location could identify this subset of patients who might actually benefit significantly from oral therapy, maybe for the first time.
So the take-home message really seems to be about location, location, location within the protein.
You got it. The CRT1 sequence is incredibly conserved, especially in those core transmembrane bits, because they're essential mutations there, usually severe loss of function.
But mutations in the peripheral parts, the NC termini or the external loops, much more likely to be tolerated or cause only a moderate hit to function.
Right. And identifying patients with those moderate hit variants, the ones with some residual function left, that's key.
Because it could dramatically change their prognosis if an effective oral therapy becomes possible for them. It really makes you think, what does this mean for developing truly personalized treatment strategies? We're finding even partial residual function could unlock the door to effective therapies for some patients with CTD, completely shifting the outlook. That's the question we'll leave you with today. This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.